honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a reminder that there were so many different ways to contribute to the Allied victory in World War II. In the case of Doug Johnson, it was operating a crane nicknamed the Wild One in the Philippines.
So you guys, I mean, what you're doing there is key to the whole effort. The logistics that you guys are carrying out are the difference between a ship, a squadron of PT boats, submarines, whatever. The difference between them having what they need or not, right, is what you guys
supply.
Were doing there?
We're a supply base.
Yeah.
And NSD, Naval Supply Depot.
And how long were those days? How many hours in a row would you be operating that crane like that?
Well, we're on 12 off 4.
Uh-huh.
And the crane inside, my crane had a bed. And I could climb on my bed, say I was on 12, and I would say I'd work 10 straight hours. And I'd get a break, maybe something, your truck would be broke down or they weren't doing something. And I'd climb in my bed, and I'd sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And my stevedore, Filipinos, come up and shake me, hey, boss, you got a truck. And so I'd get up, and I'd go back and climb in the seat, and then I'd unload. Sometimes you go 4, 5, 6 hours straight again before you got a break. So some days I wouldn't get out of that cab for other than to go to the bathroom. That was the only reason I'd get out of there. Sometimes you didn't even get out to take a leak. You just stood and peed over the side. We had a condition 2 hurricane coming in. They said to move all equipment back into a cove. And I said, I can't move this crane back there. And they said, you're given order to move that crane. Get it out of here, you know. So I got up on the track, and I blocked the whole track. Nobody could pass me or get around me, you know. And I had traffic backed up way behind me. And finally, I got to a point where they pulled me off the track and let the rest of them go by. But I blocked the whole everybody from getting up to where they're supposed to be going with it.
And they're trying to all get out of the path of a typhoon before it's too late. So what happened when the typhoon hit?
It never hit.
Ah.
We just had a lot of wind, you know, of wind. And when you're in a crane, you know, there's no windshield and there's no glass in the doors or anything. And the wind blowing, you're taking it right straight in your face, you know.
Oof.
And round the clock. But it was 120 to 124 degrees in that crane.
Well, and I'm thinking about all the veterans I've had the privilege of meeting who served in the Pacific during these times, and specifically in the Philippines. And you just mentioned one of the potential hazards, the weather. The typhoons at times were devastating. Certainly the enemy, there's the potential for a bomber coming over or, you know, an air raid or getting shelled or whatever. And then the other one would be illness, disease, malaria, dengue, all the different things that went through, beriberi. Any of those hazards that you had to deal with?
I had malaria. I went in December the 26th into the hospital. And the hospital, there were 3 Quonset huts. The center Quonset hut was for first aid. The upper Quonset hut was for VD. The bottom Quonset hut was malaria. And malaria, where I was sent to, or taken to, had 2 beds side by side. And on each bed had a rubber mat. And you laid on that one bed and went through a sweat with malaria. I had falciparum malaria, which malaria, I found out later on, there are 4 grades. The top grade is fatal. The second grade, falciparum, which is I have. The third grade is like flu. And the fourth grade is more or less like you got a real head cold. So I had falciparum. Temperature was 106 degrees.
Holy moly.
And I was laid on the bed on the rubber sheet, no covers on at all, and go through a sweat. And then when I'd start getting chills, they would roll me on the other bed, cover me all up with all kinds of blankets and everything they could. It took 2 corpsmen to pick up the rubber sheet and pour the water off. It had that much water. I was that way for 6 days, and I still never ever remember drinking any water or even feeding me or anything. I have no idea what I did for 6 days. And they brought a doctor in from Philippines, from Manila, and he looked at me and he said, wow, he said, your chart shows you 106 degrees, you're dead. He said, if you go to 107, he said, you won't make it. So the next day I went to 105. And I stayed, and I came, it was about 105, 104, somewhere near my temperature, and I heard this bugle blowing. And I asked the coroner, what's that? And he says, it's New Year's Eve. And from the 26th until the 31st, I was in sick bay not knowing who I was. When I finally got released, the commander of the base, because I was the only crane operator they had for the big crane.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, he called me Johnson or Doug, one or the other, either way. He says, you got anybody can run that crane? And I said, not that I know of. I said, I got a friend of mine, pretty sharp. And I said, his name is Egnatuck. We call him Eggy. And he says, can you train him? And I says, yeah. And he says, okay, I'm assigning you a Jeep and a driver. You're on limited duty until I tell you what. So I got Eggy, and I taught him the operation of the crane and everything. And it took me damn near 2 full months to get him to learn the picking it up, you know, and your counterweights and swinging back and forth and everything.
How long did it take you to recover from that bout with malaria?
Well, I really got over it. It seemed like pretty well. I got my appetite back and everything, but I lost a tremendous amount of weight. I weighed 206 pounds, and I wound up at 158.
Wow. And how long were you over there in the Philippines?
I went in there on 1944 in July, and I left in May of 46. When I was at Tacloban, there's an airstrip there belonging to the U.S. Air Force. I was part of a work detail, and I could drive truck. So I drove a 10-wheeler, and I would go past the airstrip down to the far end, and they would load 500-pound bombs in cases on the back of my truck. Now, on a 500-pound bomb, on the front of the bomb is a propeller, and the propeller is all the way in with clips on it. And when they get ready to drop that, they cut the wire on the clips, and as that bomb would go down, the propeller would unscrew and set the detonator off when it hit the ground. All the bombs that we had had the wires clipped. So we had those bombs in cases to move in our trucks. They didn't shift or anything. It didn't really scare us, because if one went off, you wouldn't know it anyway. But I mean, it didn't scare us. And we took it down to the jetty, and then they would offload it at the jetty with cherry pickers. I did that for 1 week. Then the next week, I was reassigned the library. And so I was working in the library, and we heard this big boom. And what happened was one of the big 500-pound bombers went off on the jetty.
Oh, wow.
And killed 42 guys.
Wow.
And
that could have been you.
Well, it could have been trucks or something. You know, you don't know who was where or what, you know.
Had you been driving that truck and you hit a pothole or something?
You could have.
Yeah. So you had a photograph in your locker the entire time you were in the Pacific?
Oh, yeah.
What was on that photograph?
I had a picture of Marianne and my sister, Pat. It was a 5x7 picture.
So it was a picture of two high school tennis players.
Yeah.
Your sister, Pat, was one of them, and you really didn't know who the other one was.
Didn't know her by name, no. It's nor she had white shorts on.
And how often did you see that picture while you were overseas?
Whenever you opened her, you know, because our lockers were like trunks.
Uh-huh.
In Quonset huts, and you'd open her up under there.
Yeah.
I never thought about her because I had no girlfriends, and
yeah.
All the guys in the barracks that I was, the Quonset hut they were in, finally at the end, Quonset hut they were in, we only had one married guy, and the rest of the guys had girlfriends. They'd get letters from her, they wouldn't get letters from her.
Is this the only picture you had in your locker?
At that time, that was the one I carried for 2,000 miles. Had stayed with it when I got home. I met her at her home. And she didn't know who I was, and I told her I was Pat's brother. And she says, oh, you're Doug. And I said, yeah, I'm Doug. And so we talked for about a half an hour. And I said, would you like to go to Carnation and have a milkshake or something? And she said, yeah, let's do that. And her boyfriend was in the living room while we were visiting.
How did he feel about that?
I don't know.
And when did you figure out that she was the same girl in the picture?
My sister Pat told me who it was, but never gave me her name. I didn't know her name.
But when you saw her in the flesh, you said, hey, that's the girl that was in that picture?
It looks like, I said, I've seen you before, I said. She said, no, you have not seen me before. So that's how we met. And that was just prior to Christmas in 1946. It was just before Christmas because I went over and got a check for work that I did for her dad.
And how long was it before you two were married?
A year we were engaged, and then the following year we were married. I only had $1,200, so that was all the money I had. And I was, at that time, I was building a theater at Biola, so I was pretty well occupied.
And 73 years later, you're still married.
Still married, and she now has become more of a boss than she was a wife in the past. You know, yes, dear, no, dear, but now it's hey, you.
For those of us who would love to be able to say someday, yes, we've been married 73 years, what wise sage advice can you share with us if we want to make it 73 years like you two have?
Well, I would say I would have to put her in a category of equal because I had no advantage over her on her ability, and she could do anything I could do and sometimes better. So all through our farming, through the building, she took care of three children. Some days when we're working on a job close by, she would come over with a new dress that she had made, and all three kids, two shirts on the boys, and the daughter had a new dress. And so she'd walk in on the job, and there were the three kids and her. So, you know, you have to admire somebody to be able to do that. So I would say she's of equal, maybe a little bit plus.
Have you ever looked at this picture?
Oh, many, many, many times.
And considered what the probability was that while you were sitting there in the Philippines as a crane operator in the Navy, looking at this picture of your sister, that the mysterious girl next to her would be your wife someday? I mean, what are the odds of that?
Never thought of that. No, I never did. I really didn't call on her. I called on her dad to get my check. And that's when I saw her.
Well, and I don't want to leave anything out. You know, if there's some other stories that come to mind, feel free to share them. But I also, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a story that we've never heard before.
You know, I tell you what, the way I feel personally, and I appreciate the thank you, but I feel personally without, I was a civilian farmer, and I grew crops, helped grow crops were used in the defense. And then when I went in the service, I admired the people that built the planes and the tanks and the guns and the bullets. Where would we have been? And I, at that time, I thought there were over 11 million in the service. Where would we have been without the civilian dedication? A lot of women worked in airplanes. When I've been down to Quartzsite, and that was a woman's air base down there that they ferried the pilots to the East Coast. The women were just as important as the men, and they welded aboard ships and they did everything. So without the civilians and the dedication that they had, they were as important to me as my job. All I was doing was stacking what they had built.
And, you know, a lot of times people will talk, they will compare World War II to conflicts that have occurred since. And I think you can make the case that what you just hit on is the most glaring difference, that we haven't had a war since World War II where the entire nation was united behind an effort and doing what they could on the home front the way they did then.
Everywhere, even in farming, you know, we had at Biola, we had a lookout tower. And I think her mother was on the lookouts. They stand up in the tower with their binoculars, and every plane that flew over, they knew what was going on or something, and they would report it accordingly. So even the housewives that didn't weld or hammer or do anything like that were dedicated to doing something in the service.
Sure.
So we fought a war of united people, and I think the United States of America really made a lot of sense from the word united. I fly the flag 24 hours a day for the simple reason that it represents the United States. And if we go back in time when they dedicated the Constitution and all the other things, the people that wrote the Constitution were thinking about other than themselves. The wrong thing I feel wrong with politicians today is they think of themselves first and what they can do second. And it's wrong.
I have one more question. I don't know if this is an easy question, but when you think of the 97 years you've spent on this planet, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, let's put it in a real simple way. I raised 3 kids along with my wife. We have 3 of what I consider the finest kids. They are all noted in what they do. I don't know of anything that makes a person more prouder of the wife that did the raising when I worked in construction than what I did teaching them farming. They all drove tractor probably before they're 8 years of age. All 3 kids come home when we have a dinner here with their families. We only have 21 people for dinner.
A blessing they enjoyed again this past week in celebrating their 73rd anniversary. You'll find a video of Doug and his wife Mary Ann on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and also at hometownheroesradio.com, where the podcast version of this episode contains additional material that wouldn't quite fit into our radio time today. Boy, that time has flown right by today, but thanks so much for listening, and thanks to the Johnsons for sharing a slice of their life with us. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.